It has been a week for us since we read chapter 4. But if you were just reading, you would move immediately, wouldn't you, from the end of chapter 4 into chapter 5. And so the closing words of chapter 4 really frame chapter 5 for us. You remember what happened in chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar, the great king, was humbled by God. You can go away and you can read that in your own time and see how that happened. It's a remarkable story. And at the end of the story, King Nebuchadnezzar, the greatest, most powerful man on earth, declares how God is in control. I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven, because everything he does is right and all his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble. And those last words, chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar's words, as I say, they frame chapter 5. Those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. In chapter 4, we saw Nebuchadnezzar walking in pride. We saw how God humbled him. And in chapter 5, we see Belshazzar walking in pride. And we see him humbled. But there is a dreadful difference between the two. And you remember that in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar was humbled, but eventually he went mad. And eventually his sanity is restored to him, and he comes to recognize who God is. But Belshazzar is humbled and dies at the hand of Darius the Mede that very night. And we said this last time, God will see you humbled before him. You are going to recognize that God is God and that you must kneel before him. And you will either do that now, joyfully, gladly, willingly, or you will bend the knee before him finally when you face him in judgment. But you will be humbled before God. And it is, as I say, a very sober, very somber passage that we come to. But it's here in the Bible. We can't skip it. We can't move on to something lighter that we might like to talk about. We're going to work through this. So let me tell you the story then. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet. There's an extravagance about King Belshazzar's banquet. He calls together 1,000 of his nobles. Wow, that's some party, isn't it? But his pride is on display here. Usually kings actually feasted kind of separately, off away from the hoi-polloi, but not for him. He wants to be the center of attention. The extravagance of the king who calls 1,000 of his lords to feast with him. But we see the decadence as well. The thing about Belshazzar, enough is never enough. Everything has to be done to excess. Here's an example. God set out a pattern for marriage. One man, one woman, joined for life. The framework for sexual intimacy. But that's not enough for Belshazzar. He doesn't have a wife, he has wives. But even having all these wives isn't enough for him, so he's got concubines as well to, distract him. A man who won't be satisfied with what God has set out is always going to be chasing after something else in order to satisfy him. So there's his wives, his concubines. But how else does he chase after? What else does he hope will satisfy him? If you read verse 1-4, it's there in front of you. Why don't you read it through as you sat there? What word comes up again and again and again in those verses? He gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets and on and on and on, so that his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and they drank from them. And as they drank the wine, do you see this? There's something else he won't be satisfied with either. They drank and they drank and they drank in this story. Well, the Bible tells us about wine. The Bible tells us that wine is a good gift from God. It tells us that wine gladdens the heart. The Bible tells us that Jesus drank wine. The Bible tells us that Jesus miraculously made wine. But it also warns us clearly, repeatedly, about the sin of drunkenness. To lose control because of drink. And we know that when we're drunk, we lose our inhibitions, don't we? We do things, people do things when they're drunk, they wouldn't dare do when they're sober. And we see that in what comes next. So we've seen his extravagance and his decadence, but now we see his insolence. Belshazzar calls for the cups, the gold and silver vessels, from God's temple. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar had captured Jerusalem and he carried off Daniel and his friends and the rest of the nation into captivity? He also brought all the stuff that was in God's temple. And he put it in the temple of his own gods. What's he saying? My God's bigger than your God. But now Belshazzar calls that the cups that have been sat in the pagan temples for these, nearly 70 years, he calls them to be used at the party. We're told that there are 5,400 vessels made of gold and silver. They're enormous value. And these are what he sends for to be used at his party. Now, in our cupboard, there's some china. It belonged to kind of Rose's grandmother's family. It's Swiss in origin. We've never actually used it, but it's there, just in case. It's not particularly valuable, but it's got that kind of family history to it. It's precious. Now, imagine Dan's 6th birthday, and we invite all his friends round, and we start serving pizza and crisps and chips off the plates and ice cream from the bowls. We say, is that appropriate, Matt? No, scrub that. Think worse, 1,000 times worse. Think this. Suppose I take the soup tureen. I've never in my life used a soup tureen, but suppose I did, and I took it, and I went out into the garden, onto the drive, and I drained the engine oil from my car into it. And I get one of those big serving platters, and the muck that accumulates in the drain outside your kitchen sink? You know the stuff, all the bits of rice and the grease and the leaves are blown and everything that's accumulated, and I start emptying that into the serving dish. Matt, that's a bit inappropriate, isn't it? No, but worse, like 1,000 times worse than that. These objects are sacred. What does that mean? It means they're given over to God. Now, we don't think much about sacred in our culture. It's not a kind of a common way we would think, but in more Eastern cultures, that would be perhaps more in their way of thinking. Here's an example. Do you know any Muslims? Do you know how a Muslim would respond if they came in here and saw your Bible dropped on the floor? Or maybe with a notebook or a hymn book placed on top of it? They'd be horrified. Why? Because the Quran, the physical printed book, they treat it with great reverence. So they would wash their hands, a kind of symbolic washing, before they pick it up. In some branches of Islam, I'm told that after it's worn out, you can't just send it off to be pulped or shredded or recycled. You might burn it in a ceremonial way, or you might wrap it in cloth and bury it in the ground. Somewhere where it wouldn't be kind of walked on, but like you would bury a person. They treat it with great reverence. But no, it's worse. It's 1,000 times worse than that. These objects are dedicated to the living God. They are gods. And they are being used, we discover, for these people to get, well, drunk as lords, quite literally, and to praise and to worship idols, fake gods, gods of stone and silver and gold. There's decadence, there's extravagance, but there's this insolence about Belshazzar. But now we've got, we discover this disturbance. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appear and write on the plaster of the wall. Picture the scene now. This enormous banqueting hall. It's 1,000 people seated there. No doubt there's musicians. No doubt there's singing. There's people, well, drunk as the Lord, quite literally. They're singing and praising the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone, pagan hymns. Suddenly there's a scream. And then everything falls quiet. Near the lampstand, not some dingy little corner where nobody sees us, but the lampstand where it can be seen, a hand has appeared. This painting is by a Rembrandt. It's in the National Gallery. It's called Belshazzar's Feast. And you can see the reaction of the king as this hand appears and inscribes these letters into the stone. White plaster covering the walls, just I suppose like this. Suddenly this hand scribing these letters into the stone. Picture the chaos. The Israelites, the Hebrews, the first people who'd been reading this, later remembered that God's fingers wrote on the tablets of stone that Moses had the law written on. And also remembered that the plagues that came against Egypt back when God was rescuing his people were described as being the finger of God. But here these fingers appear and inscribe on the wall. And the king? Well, the king, we are told, turns white. And we're told that, it very neatly in our translation says that his legs became weak because he was so frightened. But literally the idea is that the knots of his hips get loosened. Some of the commentators suspect it's incontinence. He's wet himself. He's so afraid. And his knees knock in terror. The extravagance, the decadence, the insolence, the disturbance, the incontinence. And now we get the ignorance. Because the king doesn't know what to make of it. And so he calls in all his wise men. As we've been going through the book of Daniel, we've met these wise men, and again, they keep getting called in to explain something, and they never can. You notice that? The wise men in Babylon aren't actually that wise. And the same thing happens here. They get called in, they can't explain the writing, in fact, they can't even read it. We saw it in chapter 2, we saw it in chapter 4. The wise men are bamboozled. Now, what's Belshazzar going to do? Is he going to laugh it off? Is he going to shrug and say, oh, we worry about it in the morning? No, we're told he is more fearful, even more terrified, his face even more pale, his nobles baffled. So what happens? The queen comes in. Just a word of explanation here. Belshazzar is king, but he is co-regent. He rules jointly with another king called Nabonidus, who is probably his father. And this is probably Nabonidus's queen, in other words, Belshazzar's mother. She comes in, and she's the wisest person there's been in Babylon so far, because she says, don't be afraid, don't look so pale. We're in verse 10 now. There's a man in your kingdom, what? Who has the spirit of the holy God in him. He can solve puzzles. He can untie knots. Call Daniel. And the king says, well, go get me Daniel. And Daniel comes and the king says, are you Daniel? There's a suggestion that the king, you should call Daniel. All right, go get me Daniel. Are you Daniel? The king's been drinking, hasn't he? And he's rude to Daniel. I've been told you can do this. Can you do this? Can you interpret this? If you can, there's all this in it for you. The arrogance of the man. But there you go, Daniel's respond. And you remember when Daniel spoke to Nebuchadnezzar, he was very respectful. Very concerned for the king. But now Daniel has seen the sacrilege of Belshazzar. He puts it with the rudeness of Belshazzar. And what's his answer? You can keep your gold. You can keep your rewards for giving to someone else. But I am going to tell you, the king, what it means. And then he doesn't tell the king what it means. Did you notice that? He doesn't tell the king what it means. Instead, he takes him back to primary school. And he reminds him what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, probably his grandfather. He was a great king. He was a king that God had exalted and given a great high position. And when he got proud, God humbled him. He had this delusion. He thought he was an animal. He lived outside with animals eating grass. Until he recognized that God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. That's verse 21. But, Belshazzar, you knew that. You remember being a little boy and looking out the back window of the palace and seeing Grandpa out there in the garden eating grass. You remember when your Grandpa went crazy and disappeared for those years and then came back. But although you knew all this, you haven't humbled yourself. And instead, what have you done? Verse 23, you've set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. Imagine someone in the school playground squaring up to the kind of biggest boy in the schoolyard, going toe-to-toe. That's what you've done, only not with the big boy in the schoolyard. You've gone toe-to-toe with God. This is only going to end one way, isn't it? You've set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles and your wives and your concubines, you drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood and stone, which can't see or understand, but you didn't honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. And that is why this is happening. Well, Daniel, that's a good warm-up. You've really got the king on side now. What are you going to say? What's the explanation? Well, this is what the inscription says, king. Mene, mene, tekel, parson. Which doesn't mean a great deal to you, does it? Well, how about if I put it like this? Pounds, pounds, tuppence, farthing. That's what it is. These are denominations of currency. There's a mina or a mene that... Well, it comes from the words that mean numbered, counted. And that's a big unit of currency. And then there's a shekel, tekel, which is literally to weigh something. And then there's peres, your halfpenny, the little bit that's divided, that's cut up. Well, king's still not much clearer. Okay, that's what it says. What does it mean? And so Daniel goes on and explains. You, God has numbered the days of your reign. We say that still, don't we? Your days are numbered. Yeah? God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. You've been weighed. You've been found wanting. We still use scales as a symbol of justice. Go to the law courts. You'll see there the statue on the top of them. What it is justice. She's blindfolded and she's holding her scales. Well, you, Belshazzar, when you've been weighed, you come up short. You don't measure up. You're light. And you've been divided. Your kingdom and its power has been broken in two. It's been given to the Medes and the Persians. Wow. Daniel, how to win friends and influence people? How does a king respond? Is there weeping? Is there repentance? Does he realize what he's been like and how far astray he's gone? No. He's as good as his word. He sends for the gold chain. Daniel gets the purple robes. He gets declared a ruler. There is absolutely no sense in the king at all of being humble. Rather, I'm the king. Nice story, Daniel. Thank you for coming in and sharing that with us. But remember who's king. Daniel scuttles off. That very night, we are told, the king was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. As he feasted, the armies of Darius are besieging Babylon. You see, the walls around Babylon are impenetrable, Belshazzar presumes. I'm invulnerable, nothing can touch me. And so he's inside, although the army's outside, but he's inside partly like it's 1999. And if you read ancient historical accounts, what happens is this. Darius diverts the river Euphrates. He had a whole bunch of civil engineers who build a series of dams, waterways. They divert the river. The river runs down into the city, only now it doesn't because he sent it somewhere else. And because the river isn't there, Darius can just march his armies down the dried up riverbed, bypass the walls, go straight into the city and capture it. That's the military strategy behind it, but what's lying underneath is this. God is in control. And God is going to humble Belshazzar. Well, that's the story. It's a great story. I mean, you can make a really good film out of this. Think of yourself in the position of the Israelites. fearful, suffering in exile, what a message of encouragement it would have been to them. To be reminded that their God is not helpless against the Babylonian gods, the fake gods of stone and iron and wood. On the contrary, their God is the Most High God. Babylon's gods are as dead as the stone and the wood and the gold that makes them up. But Israel's God has shown his rule, his sovereignty. He's judged the Babylonian king for his sacrilege. And he's given his kingdom over to someone else. God is sovereign over everything. Your future is in God's hand. Now that statement is either a great cause of encouragement to you, or it ought to strike terror into you. Your future is in God's hand. Chapter 2 told us about the succession of kingdoms that would follow on. Eventually there would be a great eternal kingdom set up. And now in chapter 5, that promise, that prophecy, that succession of kingdoms is coming one step nearer. The kingdom of humble beginning. Christ's kingdom that outlasts every other kingdom. The kingdom not made by human hands. That kingdom, God's kingdom, is coming. It's one step nearer. Get ready. But I think we have to see this as well. This message of God's judgment inscribed by God's finger in the wall. Exodus 31:18 tells us that God, with his finger, inscribed his law on tablets of stone. And they are also a message of judgment. 10 commandments. 10 commandments inscribed by God. You know? Don't steal. Don't lie. Don't covet. Don't lust. Don't hate. Don't blaspheme. Don't neglect the Lord's day. Don't dishonor your parents. Don't worship falsely. Don't put anything else in God's place. How are you doing on those? They condemn you. They condemn me, don't they? There they are, inscribed on stone, and they pronounce judgment on you and on I just as surely as this did on Belshazzar. We could go through them. I could expand on them. I don't even think I need to. Let's pick one. Let's make it easy. Don't lie. You ever told a lie? You're condemned. It's what the Bible teaches us. We're condemned by those tablets of stone just as surely as Belshazzar is condemned by the writing on the wall. You know, there's a sense in which time is running out for Belshazzar. It's the end of the road. The writing's on the wall. The same warning hangs over us. Carry on rejecting God's mercy. Carry on thumbing your nose at his patience, and one day he will say, well, enough is enough. I don't know when that'll be. It's not that you need to be very bad. It's not that you need to go away and commit some outrageous sin. No, you're polite, you're respectable, your little rebellions, they're enough. Carry on the road you're following. It will lead you to judgment. You will find yourself under God's curse, under his anger, his wrath, condemned to God's hell. You spend a lifetime saying, I don't want you, God. And God will say, right, off you go then. Eternity without him. That's the condemnation that's hanging over Belshazzar. That's the condemnation that is inscribed on those tablets of stone and hangs over us. How on earth are we going to escape? We've been weighed and found wanting. The writing is on the wall. Inscribed in stone by God for everyone to see, we're condemned. What are we going to do about it? How can we escape this judgment that God is warning us about? It's too late for Belshazzar. Is it too late for you? What if somehow Belshazzar could scratch out the writing on the wall? What if you and I could somehow cancel out God's law, written on in stone by God's finger, but we could somehow get rid of it? Jesus can. Huh? How? Oh yeah. That's what Jesus does. You could go away and you could read it in Colossians in chapter 2. Let me read it to you. When you were dead in your sins and in your sinful nature, God made you alive with Christ. He forgave us all our sins, having cancelled the written code, the law. With the regulations that were against us and stood opposed to us, what did he do about it? He took it away and nailed it to the cross. You want to do with that inscription that condemns you? Jesus has taken it away. Jesus has taken that law and nailed it to the cross. The record of our law breaking, our rebellion against God, our turning our back on him and going our own way, our sin, that record of our fault has been nailed to the cross along with Jesus. There is a way of escape. There's a way of forgiveness. But friend, your days are numbered. My days are numbered. And when we're weighed, we come up light. Yeah, the writing's on the wall for us. And if we carry on, we'll get what we deserve. We'll bring God's judgment on ourselves. But look, there is a way of escape. There is a way of pardon. There is a way of forgiveness. It's laid open for you in Jesus. Belshazzar has hardened himself. He doesn't want any part of it. But to you, here's the invitation. Come to Jesus and live. Come to Jesus and have your judgment dealt with. Come to Jesus and have the inscription scrubbed out. And the list of your shortcomings, well, nailed to a cross.